ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, Sarah Kanoski here. I recently sat down for a conversation with the former Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern. We talked about her upbringing as a good Mormon girl, her unusual path into political leadership, and how she navigated some of the most terrible events in the history of New Zealand.
I felt such rage that part of the way they designed this horrific attack was to try and get people to react violently.
Hear my conversation with Jacinda Ardern now by searching for Conversations on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. If you're a true crime junkie, you may have had an Only Murders in the Building style fantasy. A fascinating case crosses your path, the authorities are bungling it, and it falls to you and your incisive mind to solve the case and bring a criminal to justice. Well, an amateur investigator has ended up giving evidence in court after what she calls a reckless plan to take investigating a cold case into her own hands. That is in the next 20 minutes. Also ahead, she bakes her own bread, she grows her own vegetables, she homeschools her kids, but don't call her a trad wife. A rural mum pushes back against people romanticising her life or assuming her politics. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, grandparenting can come at a time of your life where your old identities no longer fit. You're thinking about retirement, your grown kids have their own things going on, and the things that used to fill your days are no longer occupying as much time as they once did. But then grandkids arrive, and there's that rush of love and connection that you experience the first time with your own kids, and a fresh opportunity. Do you want to be the same kind of grandparent as you were as a parent? Or is this a chance to do things differently, maybe better? Or maybe it's a confronting change to your identity. Grandparents are meant to be old, and you're not old. Anyway, the opportunities for grandparental transformation can be pretty profound if you're ready to take them, and that is what I am diving into today on The Grandparent Trap. Throughout July on Life Matters, we're unpacking what it means to be a grandparent in 2026 based on your stories. And one thing that you have been telling me about, especially the granddads out there, is how much this has been a time to reinvent yourself. I've been hearing from men who are trying to step into the caring role as a granddad in a way that for one reason or another they weren't able to as dads. So I'd love to hear from you today, both the grandmas and the granddads. Tell me your stories about how grandparenting has changed you. Are you gaining a new understanding of your own children? Are you trying to do things differently to the way you parented? How are you reinventing yourself as a grandparent? Give me a call. You're about to hear from a couple of granddads and from a geropsychologist who can talk about what this transition can look like. But I'm going to start with Julian Mather here with me in studio, a new granddad trying to be a modern granddad. Welcome.
Hello.
So tell me about the day that you became a granddad.
23 months ago, my little grandson was born and I went in and I picked him up and I put him here and I just fell in love straight away. Like I was not expecting it. And, you know, I just wanted to be the best granddad I could be. And I wanted to help his parents. I wanted to grow as a person. And I wanted to do it with like-minded men. So I started looking for like-minded men to go on this journey with. I found that there were support groups for men who were lonely, but I'm not lonely. There were support groups for kinship carers, but who look after grandkids full-time and need support. I don't need support. There were church groups. I'm not religious. I started to read grandparenting books, but I found out they were grandmothering books more than anything. I started my own new granddad club and no one turned up. I went to a Lions club and tried to start a partnership with them, but they weren't interested. I talked to a federal member of parliament. They were interested, but I wasn't ready. And it's weird, you know, like this, there's never been a time there's been more grandparents on the planet than there are now. There's 700 million grandparents out there, granddads out there, and I can't connect with them. So, but anyway, look, you know, I'm going to be the best granddad I can be. And one of the things that, you know, really concerns me now is I don't want to lose my grandson to online strangers with strange ideas. So I see that as my responsibility then to try to make the offline world more attractive to him. So, you know, I'm not naive. I know that I'm not a match to social media companies with a trillion-dollar budget, but I realised I have one thing that they don't have. I have my grandson's attention for the first 5 to 10 years of his life, and I see that as an opportunity that I'm not going to let pass by. So I've just started writing and making videos about the things we're doing together and about how he has turned into this little life coach in nappies for me. It's just been wonderful. And he's given me so much purpose, and men need purpose. And I see all these men around me retiring who are struggling to find purpose.
So when you were becoming a granddad, when your child was expecting a baby, what were you anticipating? It sounds like it's been like a hugely transformative moment. What were you anticipating grandfatherness to look like for you?
I was excited about it, but yeah. I thought I would go in and take a secondary role because my wife, you know, Remy's grandmother, I mean, she's just fantastic at what she does. But I just found that I wanted to step up and you know, I wanted to be a big presence in this boy's life. And I don't know whether that, because I had two daughters myself, and I don't know whether that is a delayed response to that. I don't know, but I was just so excited that this was an opportunity for me. What I wanted to do was not get to the end of my life and have a regret and say, wow, this could have been something special and I just let it slip by.
So has it changed you as a person, do you think?
Yes. Yeah. I'm much more, like I said, he's like this little life coach in nappies. He's changed me with what I see myself wanting to do. I mean, I'll just give you a clear example. I bought a bike and I put a seat on the front for him. And that was a particular choice to put that seat on the front because I've got a very big thing about building agency in children. If you have the child behind, like they're a passenger in life, metaphorically. So he's in the front seat and we just talk and pick flowers and I pick them up a couple of times a week on the bike. And then the other week I was not talking to him much and I realised in my head I still do a bit of work and I'd missed out on this work opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I just went, oh, you idiot. I've never been happier in the last 12 months than I've been on that bike with him. And here's me on the bike with him thinking about how I can get work to earn money to give me freedom to do the things I want to do, which is be on the bike with him. So he's changed me like that. He's just made me realize, like I'm there. I've climbed the mountain.
Mm. Is your grandchild a life coach in nappies like Julian's Remy? This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National, part 4 of our series, The Grandparent Trap, talking about reinventing yourself as a grandparent or grandparenthood as a time for reinvention. And I'd love to know if this is something that you identify with, if becoming a grandparent has made you reflect about who you want to be, either as a grandparent or just as a person. And also here with us is Dr. Amanda Salmon. She researches geropsychology and older adults at the University of Queensland. Amanda, listening to Julian's story, is that a surprising story to you?
Not necessarily. I think that, you know, we're now living in a world where people are living a lot longer. They're a lot healthier. So long gone is this idea of the grandparents sitting at home, twiddling their thumbs, knitting or out in the sheds. Now everybody's so much more healthier and having done a lot of interviews with a lot of older people across my career, I find that the biggest misunderstanding is that these old people are just sitting around doing nothing, whereas nothing could be further from the truth. They're incredibly busy. A lot of them are still working, they're volunteering. And so by the time they become a grandparent, it's a lot of them, it becomes kind of a shock. It's like, oh, I'm suddenly old. I didn't realise that this had happened to me. And the idea of thinking back to the old stereotype of this grandparent and going, well, that doesn't really connect with me. And so I think that, you know, hearing other more and more stories are coming out that they're just not connecting in the to this idea of being old. And so they want to be more engaged. They want to, you know, spend, you know, for some of them, they don't have a lot of spare time. And so being able to allocate that to caring for a grandchild and imparting that knowledge and leaving almost a legacy to this child, we're just seeing more and more of it.
There's nothing that either makes you feel really old or really young than hanging out with a really young child. They either bring out the youth in you or they make you feel very creaky. Amanda, what's the sort of, what can happen when we bring sort of old and young people together?
So we see a huge amount of benefits. So whether it's an actual grandparent relationship or whether it's just, you know, visiting an older person in an aged care facility or anything like that, we see huge benefits for mental health for that older person. And we see huge improvements in that child as well with things like their communication and their ability to connect and at an emotional level as well. You know, we know that there can be a lot of people getting divorced and things like that. So being able to have that grandparent or older person figure can also be huge in those areas. But even just in general, like I know my personal experience, I've got a 2-year-old at home and he's lucky enough to have both grandparents and great-grandparents. Oh. And so getting to see, you know, his great-grandfather also light up and get excited. Like we get to see such a huge benefit just firsthand, which has been incredible.
It's so beautiful. And Julian, throughout this series, people have been telling me just how much they love their grandkids. It's so wonderful. Were you surprised when you were putting all those calls out? Sounds like you did a lot of legwork and you just weren't getting a response from grandfathers.
Oh, I was naive when I started. I was quietly excited, like, oh, isn't this going to be good? And we're all going to be together and it's going to be rough and tumble with the kids and we'll have a beer and have a... I was a little shocked. And what surprised me was the response that I got, 99% of it was from women.
Mm.
And they were so supportive. This is a great idea. Wow. I've got to, here, I'm, you know, tagging my, you know, my father in on that. And when I did get to speak to men about it, they didn't want to talk. Like I met, we're just so out of touch with talking about these sort of things. And I mean, I don't know why. So I'm just stumbling my way through this, you know, trying to work it out myself.
So women wanting to set men up with these social opportunities and men not interested in taking them on. Amanda, is that a typical pattern?
I'm not quite so sure. I think for some people it certainly is, and it can be confronting going through these life changes and again realizing, oh, that I'm old, and this old idea socially of, oh, all that stuff is for the women. But I think we're seeing more and more people like Julian coming out and saying, well, no, actually, I really want to be involved. And I think it's just so crucial for grandfathers out there everywhere, as well as grandmothers, obviously, but for the grandfathers to, you know, take that time, take that opportunity, because I think when you start spending time with a younger person, it almost makes you feel younger, like you get to have that excitement. And for the dads out there who have spent their entire life working and stressing and supporting families, you know, for them to then have the opportunity to have more spare time and have that time with that grandchild, I think for some people, like I know my father's had a hugely stressful career running his own business, whereas now he has that chance to back off and semi-retire. He is just so excited to play with the kids, to the point where me and my brother are sitting back going, oh geez, where was that fun? Where was that fun person when we were kids?
Absolutely. You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, bringing you The Grandparent Trap, our special series that we've been bringing you throughout July. I'm chatting with Julian Mather, Remy's granddad, author of The Modern Granddad newsletter on Substack, and Dr. Amanda Salmon, who studies geropsychology and older adults at the University of Queensland. We're talking about the possibilities of reinvention that can come when you become a grandparent. I wonder how becoming a grandparent has changed you. Tell me about how becoming a grandparent has shifted maybe how you see yourself. And one text here, a love letter to you, Julian. OMG, this person says, how beautiful is this grandfather? He's nailed it. What a lucky grandchild. What a lucky daughter. Well, also here with us is Alistair Thompson, Emeritus Professor at Monash University. He's the co-author of Fathering, an Australian History, and he is the granddad to Finn and Isla. Alistair, welcome back to Life Matters.
G'day, hi. Good to speak to you too. You know, I love the idea of the life coach in nappies.
Have you got a couple of those as well?
I've got a couple of those as well. Just dropped them off at preschool. And he's absolutely right, Julian. You learn so much from little kids, that energy, that curiosity, the hugs you don't expect, the tantrums every now and then. It's an extraordinary opportunity.
Alistair, you've been looking through history at the way we've looked at least fathers throughout Australian history. Do you think there's a shift as well about what it means to be a grandfather?
Look, I think there's a lot of things that have shifted. I mean, one, we now know for sure that grandparents do a really significant chunk of childcare in Australia, and they do that because most Australian families these days need two incomes, and so both parents are working. And so you're going to have to find alternative sources of childcare, and childcare is expensive, and so if grandparents are available, they're really chipping in a huge way. We know that for sure. I'm less sure about the statistics on grandmothers and grandfathers. I'm pretty sure anecdotally that grandmothers still do a lot more of the hard grind than grandfathers, but that doesn't mean there aren't a lot of granddads out there like Julian who are playing a really active role. And there's no doubt that that's a different role, because throughout the 20th and early 21st century, most dads, the role that they've been expected to play is that of breadwinner, and childcare and raising small kids has been on the side. And the proportion of men being primary carers for children as fathers has never got over 5 or 6% in the last 50 years. It sort of went up in the 70s and 80s, and then it leveled off, and it's never been much more than that. So, a lot of dads haven't been able to play, just as Amanda was talking about her dad. Suddenly he's able to do things with his grandkids that he wasn't able to do as a dad, and I think that is certainly true. And the grandfathers who are open to the opportunities of spending time with kids, we're all living longer and healthier, and therefore we've got a bit more time in our lives to do it. We might be working flexibly, mixing in with other activities. But if finding time and making time to be with your grandchildren is just so life-affirming and wonderful. It's great for the kids to get those different perspectives that older people bring, but it's also great for us older people.
Absolutely. Well, one person who's living the dream is John, who've called in. John, how has your relationship with your step-granddaughter changed your life?
Well, absolutely, because never thinking for one minute that I would ever have a beautiful little girl in my care with in conjunction with my wife. It's really been amazing. I'm 82 now and I'm doing okay. I'm keeping young. So that's the main thing.
That's wonderful. Thanks so much for the call, John. Shout out to you and your step-granddaughter. Kate, how is your dad involved in your kids' life?
It was my husband's stepdad. Mm-hmm. And he would pick up my son from daycare 3 days a week. And they were best mates. They would play computer games. He had a massive collection of army miniatures, and he would take him through the history of all the armies around the world. He was the most spectacular grandfather anyone could possibly want or need. And it brought this loving side of him that his children had never seen. It was just the most wonderful thing. But the sad side of grandparents is they're not always with us for very long.
Kate, thank you.
It was wonderful.
Thank you so much for sharing that. It's interesting, this idea that he was a different parent than he was a grandparent. Julian, I'm wondering how different your parenting style was to your grandparenting approach.
I think I did an okay job at parenting, but, I was treading water and I was just making it up as I was going along. I've just had the time to step back and then reflect and learn and not wait to be taught about this. And my so I, my style is far more proactive. And I think, you know, as a parent, again, I mean, I took the assistant coach role to my wife who, you know, did all the heavy lifting. You know, I don't think that was unusual for doing that, but you know, I see that role, in a sense, flipping now.
Alistair, do you see that sense that people wanted to be more, that dads and grandfathers wanted to be more involved in their children and grandchildren's lives, but society didn't expect that of them?
Look, I think it's partly about cultural expectations, and those have certainly changed since sort of second wave feminism in the 70s. There's an increasing expectation that men should play a significant role in their children's lives or their grandchildren's lives. I think what's made that really hard is the economics of parenting and differentials in wages between men and women and so on, so that men have tended to be primary breadwinners. And increasingly, as women have been doing paid work as well, men have continued to. So it's about time and it's about the nature of the workforce. It's really hard for young dads to make time, you know, to spend with their kids more than just after schools or in the evenings or whatever. And I think one of the big shifts about when you move into a later stage of your life and maybe you start working part-time, maybe you retire, you've got other activities and so on, but you've actually got the time you didn't have as a father. As Julian was saying, you've got the time to really be proactive, to focus on it. And when granddads take up that opportunity, I think that's an extraordinary opportunity. And they do often find things out about themselves as parents, and they think back to how they were as parents and think, yeah, well, it would have been good if I'd actually spent a bit more time and so on. But those qualities, those possibilities are still there. So it's really exciting. And, you know, I've certainly loved it. The last few years, it's just been terrific. And I think one of your, it might have been Amanda, mentioned about great-grandparents. My mum's 95 and she's living up the beach from my daughter and grandchildren, and every now and then they drop in and see her in the aged care home or they take her out, and the look on her face as a 95-year-old woman having these two little kids, and yes, it's a bit noisy and so on, but it really brings something to her. And when you walk through the aged care home with these two little toddlers, two little kids, the sort of gleam in the eye of all these older men and women when they see these small kids and they want to go and talk to them, they want to say hi, it's just gorgeous.
Mm. Julian, you look like you've got something on the tip of your tongue there.
Oh, no, I was just thinking, I see this such an opportunity here for older men have this great reservoir of experience and wisdom and it's sitting there, their idol. I would like to see granddads elevated from a hobby to a leadership role. And Alistair was talking about dads not having the time now with working to fulfil that leadership. And it's not about taking over that role, but stepping up and helping within that role. I just see there's an opportunity. But in my experience with trying to connect with these other men, I found that I'm wondering, is granddad out of date? Is that term, is that language? Because, you know, I mean, I've got 15, 20 years of energy and contribution left in me, but we talk about grandparents, we still have this role of, you know, this idea of people sitting in a rocking chair in, you know, late 60s, 70s with a rug on their lap, and it couldn't be further from the truth.
Amanda, what are the mental health benefits if people take up the grandparenting mantle in the way that Julian and Alistair are talking about?
I think it allows for people who are going through multiple changes in later life, it gives them that opportunity to not just be engaging but to get something out of it that goes both ways, because they get to impart this knowledge, and in particular the word wisdom. I think as we get older and we develop this wisdom and we learn these different things, then we're much better able to engage in these kids in a way that we weren't able to when we didn't have that knowledge. And also the idea of leaving a legacy, you know, as you get older, you're not necessarily thinking of the word legacy, but you're thinking about, okay, well, how am I going to leave my mark on the world? Like, how can I teach these young people? And so being able to take over a more active role in care, I think, provides such a unique opportunity to be able to incidentally impart that knowledge. You know, suddenly you've got a two-year-old who's fascinated in what you're doing. Show me how to do that thing. And so a lot of the time it's not even active teaching, it's just all this incidental sharing back and forth of stories and skills and things that otherwise you just wouldn't have the opportunity to learn. So I think, yeah, it'd be interesting to see the suggestion of what we would use instead of grandparenthood, because I think that we get this idea in our head of what a grandparent looks like and this old aged stereotype, and it's simply not true. You know, we're seeing more sprightly older adults, if you will. Mm. You know, you don't feel old. You know, you want to be out there and playing with these kids, and so it's important people don't get stuck on this idea of, oh no, now I'm old, what do I do? I should be sitting down, my knees are gone. No, the more we can get you out and engaging with these kids, the better, because you realise that stereotype doesn't hold true and you have so much to teach these kids, especially for granddads, I think.
So it's obviously something you're so passionate about, Julian. Briefly, what's your kind of call to arms here?
My call to arms is, I mean, for me personally, it's is to help build agency and competence in my grandchild. And I do that just by simply showing up with the simple eloquence of example. And I just, every time he's with me, I just show that when I've got a problem, I don't need the courage of a lion, I don't need the wisdom of Buddha, I don't need the confidence of a Formula One driver. All I need is a bit of spine, a willing mind, and a daily dose of mild discomfort, and I'll sort the problem out.
Well, Julian, Amanda, Alistair, thank you all so much for sharing your wisdom with me today. Julian Mather, Remy's granddad, author of the Modern Granddad newsletter on Substack. Alistair Thompson, Finn and Isla's granddad, also emeritus professor at Monash University and co-author of Fathering and Australian History. And Dr. Amanda Salmon, who researches geropsychology and older adults at the University of Queensland. And on Not Sounding Old, one text says, my grandchildren call me Bill. Granddad, etc., are for oldies. Well, you're listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, you've got your favourite true crime podcasts. You've listened enough, you reckon you'd make a decent detective yourself. But what happens when the lines between listening and participating get blurred? True crime podcasts have become a mainstay of popular culture. It's a thrill. You get to witness an unsolved murder laid out neatly in narrative format, and you think, how hard could it be? I could solve this. Detective ME is on the case. Well, last week, a Queensland woman admitted to just that when presenting evidence at an inquest into the 1989 murder of 15-year-old Annette Mason. Her connection to the teenager? Well, none, really. This woman was just a bit true crime obsessed. And after listening to podcasts and reading articles about Annette's case, she decided to cozy up to one of the suspects in the hopes of finding fresh evidence. In her own words, she did something reckless. So is all this true crime making us a bit too lax about murder? How many amateur detectives are actually out there? And what influence are true crime podcasts exerting on the courts? Well, you'll hear from a criminologist in a sec, as well as a true crime reporter, but I do want to hear from you. Are you a true crime junkie? What is it about that genre that intrigues you? Have you ever found yourself researching a particular case? Also, if you have podcast recommendations, I want to hear them. Here with me is Stephen Stockwell, host of The Case Of, a true crime podcast from the ABC. Stephen covered the Erin Patterson trial in the Mushroom Case Daily as well. Stocky, welcome to Life Matters.
G'day.
So when you hear this woman trying to solve a case on her own, does this surprise you?
Not at all. I reckon we probably get an email once a week or so to the Case Of inbox, thecaseof@abc.net.au, with someone kind of outlining investigations that they've done or work that they've done looking into something as well. And I mean, even as recently as the most recent Unravel season, what became of Jack, you know, there was sections in that where they were talking about people doing their own kind of sleuthing and investigating and kind of trying to reach out to people involved in that as well. So this is something that I think happens all of the time. And it's something that, I mean, the ABC is doing as well. You look at Unravel, you look at Trace, series that the ABC's done. You know, we've got, you know, we're a mainstream media outlet, so we've got people and resources around that, but we're effectively kind of doing a similar thing to what this woman is doing as well when we're doing that kind of true crime and investigative reporting into, you know, unsolved cases.
When you get those emails, are you like a kindred spirit or are you like a weirdo?
I mean, it depends a lot on how the email's written. You know, I'm not going to throw anyone under the bus here, but there's certainly a few that I get and I, you know, kind of skim through and you get a sense from the, you know, the style of that, that maybe that's not worth a huge amount of your time going deep into.
You were doing the daily podcast covering the Erin Patterson case in Morwell for the Mushroom Case Daily. Were you seeing people who were there in a voyeuristic sense over that trial?
I don't know. I mean, there were people who didn't act in a becoming manner in at moments in the courtroom, but you know, we have an open justice system. So anyone's entitled to go in and sit in court and watch what's unfolding and seeing how that goes. So people have a curiosity or an interest, they can go and do that, not just for the Erin Patterson trial, but we see that for a lot of the trials that we cover and, you know, a lot of trials that happen, the various courts around the country will have just members of the public sitting in them, following along and kind of keeping track of. So I think there's a real interest in, you know, criminal justice and the justice system. So you know, in that sense, there were certainly a lot of people there trying to follow what was going on. I don't think there was anyone in Morwell who was trying to kind of, you know, solve a case in the way that it sounds like this woman might have been in Queensland.
Also with us is Greg Stratton, who's a senior lecturer in criminology and justice studies at RMIT. Greg, when you're sort of hearing stories like this case in Queensland, what springs to mind for you?
The main thing that pops into my mind with it is sort of this line between entertainment and information, and that when some of these stories maybe move into the entertainment side a little bit more, that sort of fandom and some of those entertainment type behaviours click in rather than that sort of sense of justice and the ideas that we think about how the criminal justice systems work.
Greg, does it have an impact on how the justice system operates?
It can do. It all depends on the type of case. It depends on what level of case we're looking at, whether it's an appeal, whether it's a trial, whether it's murder, whether it's corruption, whatever that issue is, it can have a different outcome for different cases in terms of potentially biasing jurors or in some of the investigative stages, potentially tarnishing some of that evidence.
Stocky, like, with respect, how is what you do different to what an amateur detective might do? Like, you have a podcast about it. You're not a lawyer.
Yep. I mean, look, really, we are just trying to help people understand the process, right? And the ABC has quite robust editorial and legal processes behind us as well. So, you know, it's unlikely that we're going to go out and start talking to, you know, someone who may be involved in, you know, a criminal matter like this without understanding the risks that would have. You know, you don't want to, you know, if you've got information about the case, you don't want to go to that person and start telling them what you know, because that might be information that the police have deliberately hidden for a while to try and figure out, you know, if they actually have the right person when the time comes. You know, there was a trial we did, we covered recently, where the police had held on to a couple of details from the investigation. So when they talked to people about it, if they revealed that information, they knew that they hadn't got that from anywhere else. They must have been in the house to know those details. So I think that's the bigger difference for us, is that we have this kind of structural, we have this big organization behind us basically that kind of insulates and protects us from, you know, making these mistakes, from prejudicing a trial, from causing any issues in the criminal process, because obviously we don't want to, you know, prejudice a trial, mean that, you know, we don't have to do anything that actually stops an investigation going forward and someone being held responsible for something in the future.
You're listening to Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm talking to Stephen Stockwell, host of The Case Of here at the ABC, and Greg Stratton, a senior lecturer in criminology and justice studies at RMIT, talking about true crime and its effects on the justice system. There was a case in Queensland recently where a woman basically took it under her own steam, decided to investigate a case and has ended up presenting evidence at a court. I'd love to know, what is the appeal of true crime for you? One person says, I have been obsessively sleuthing through Trove after discovering that a great uncle, now long dead himself, was accused of murder but let off for insufficient evidence early last century when he was a young man. He would have been hanged if he'd been found guilty at the time. But what really happened? Well, that is a really interesting case. There's actually a new ABC series called The Dead Can't Sue, which feels very relevant to your interests there. Another question that I might put to you, Greg, from the text line, what happens when people trying to solve a crime are those sitting on the jury?
It can have a massive impact. It's actually interesting that idea of Trove as well, is because what we see with true crime, especially current versions of true crime, is that the technology and the access to archives, whether they're historical archives like Trove or the case files that might be available online in terms of just the court proceedings or the media that was around a case, that can have massive impacts on how jurors perceive the crime or the incident or the people involved in that crime, whether that's the offender or victim or the family or the high profile nature of the case. So it can have sort of a swaying effect, maybe. We don't quite know, because you don't know what all jurors are watching or listening to prior to a trial, but it can have an influence and has had influence where we have had jurors reading materials or listening to podcasts while trials are going along.
Mm. You mentioned a word before that I wanted to pick up on, Greg, this idea of almost a fandom around popular cases. What do you mean by that?
It's probably some of that separation between the real life and the experience of what happens in the courtroom or what happens in the investigation, and sort of the real experiences of living people in this sense, whether that's, again, families, victims, offenders, or that because we consume this. And when I'm talking about true crime here, I'm not just talking about podcasts, I'm talking about things like the Netflix TV series and documentary series as well, that we watch that or listen to those in our comfortable environments where we're used to having engagement as fans or as audiences. So we end up potentially engaging with real stories, true crime, as entertainment, and put on our fan hats in that way, in the same way that we watch the true crime documentary in the same space that we watch He-Man or we watch the football on the weekend, so that it's easy for us as an audience to slip into that fan mode. And whether that's being a fan of a type or a genre, or whether that's being a fan, which we are increasingly seeing, a fan of the protagonists in a true crime documentary. Mm.
Stocky, if I'm not mistaken, you weren't like a career crime reporter before the Mushroom case. Listen to you chuckle. What has it, like, has it shifted the way you see true crime being on the inside of it now?
I think a little bit. I mean, the thing that I find I have brought to this is actually that kind of exterior view. So I've brought just sort of broadly a kind of storytelling and journalism background and a way to kind of, you know, I think what Greg's saying there around the interest in these bigger, the sort of entertainment aspect of it. I think what we've been trying to do, at least with the case of, is that when you have these big cases that people are interested in and there is this sort of like, you know, avenue of the aspect of entertainment to it, using that to then educate people as a gateway to educate people about the justice system and the legal system. Like, we take people quite deep into the kind of the courtroom processes and all of that. And I think the thing that me being not a court reporter historically has helped with is that I kind of sit there and don't understand what's going on and want to have these questions answered. And the ABC, as this organization, has so many incredible court reporters who know these processes so well. So I can ask these, you know, what are effectively pretty dumb questions, and they can answer them in a way that, you know, if I can understand, you know, the rest of the audience can understand as well. So I think that's what was brought me through the whole thing. It's been really interesting in learning about that as well. I mean, there's certainly, you know, there's so much you need to know around courts. And again, we're very lucky at the ABC to have great lawyers, great editorial oversight, because without all of that, I would be completely at sea without that background.
Greg, is there any role for true crime podcasts or for, you know, amateur investigators in solving these sorts of crimes?
Totally. Like, exactly what we're talking about here is that there's a really important version of true crime that, and again, ABC is actually, it is part of what I would sort of call the good side of true crime, where this dispersal of public narrative can be really important, that we get to present versions of stories. So I work in the wrongful conviction space, where we have claims where people are in prison for crimes they didn't commit. And true crime is a really good opportunity, one, for those people to have their story heard, so that someone out there actually understands what they're going through and maybe in the best circumstances is able to present some evidence somewhere to overturn a conviction. And the sort of the cathartic nature of being able to present those narratives can be really, really helpful in the wrongful conviction space. But also sort of a public awareness about some of the dangers in society or what's actually happening within the justice system, but again, more broadly, that there's cultural, gendered issues in society that maybe don't get picked up when we just watch it through a one-minute clip on the news, that being able to deep dive into these stories is really important for sort of public understanding and understanding the complexities of life and the criminal justice system.
Well, Greg, I'm glad you've given us a free pass to continue enjoying true crime and for Stocky to continue doing his job. Thank you both so much for joining me. Dr. Greg Stratton, Senior Lecturer in Criminology and Justice Studies at RMIT. He's written a book, Innocence Unveiled, The Systemic, Social and Structural Factors Behind Wrongful Convictions in Australia. And Stephen Stockwell, host of The Case Of, a true crime podcast from the ABC. You can hear all the episodes on ABC Listen. I promise this wasn't like a sponsored post. It just kind of ended up that way. Well, you are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, what do you do when your life is reduced to a stereotype? If you've spent any time on social media lately, or even if you haven't, you've probably come across the tradwife trend. Women embracing a very traditional role of homemaker, baking bread, making their kids' clothes from scratch, tending the veggie patch on their picture-perfect farm. The tradwife movement has attracted plenty of criticism for romanticising outdated gender roles and spruiking a frugal DIY life while the women fronting it are making a pretty penny. But what do you do when people start to compare your life to that of a tradwife? Well, Renee Vincent is a cattle farmer and mum from southwest Queensland, and she is sick of the assumptions people are making about what rural life was like, to the point where she was ready to throw some sourdough. You're about to meet Renee, but I'd also love to hear from you. Have people made assumptions about you and your life, maybe because of where you live or what you do or your role in the home? I'd love to hear about that. What assumptions do people make about you based on external indicators? Renee decided rather than to throw sourdough, she would speak up instead and debunk some myths about the lives of rural women. Renee, welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
It's great to be speaking with you. So you were getting compared to a trad wife. Why was that offensive to you?
I suppose it's a bit of a two-pronged sword, isn't it? On the one hand, you've got the tradwife movement is so outward-facing, social media-facing, I suppose. Everything just is so pretty, and it's, you look around yourself and you think, that is not what this is. And on the other hand, you know, tradwife has a few connotations which are a little bit darker in terms of just a woman's role in the world these days. And it was just a little confronting, I suppose.
Yeah, let's start with the first bit. Talk to me about what the unglamorous parts of your life look like.
It's all unglamorous. oh gosh, it's I should have prepared better for this. It's just cows are not glamorous, you know. Making a living off cows is not pretty in any way. It's a kitchen that was painted avocado green in the 70s and will probably remain that way for the rest of its life. It is kids that just run feral quite a lot, because when there's so much to do and support generally is a long way away, then it's, yeah, parenting isn't always pretty either. I can't think of a part of my life that is glamorous, to be honest.
Well, you're speaking on the radio right now. Renee, can you talk to me a bit about, like, paint a picture of where you are? Like, you're in southwest Queensland. How big is your property? How many cows are you in charge of at the moment?
Yeah, again, not all that fancy. So we're near Injune. It's a 7,000-acre property. I usually run sort of 300 to 400 breeders, but we're downsizing at the moment because it's quite dry. Also, not much fun. That's, yeah, about where we're sitting at the moment.
Yeah. And so in addition to running a farm, you're homeschooling your kids, is that correct?
Yeah, the oldest two. I have a 7-year-old, a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old.
And when another one of the things that you've sort of spoken out about most recently is about just sort of the realities of rural life, the access to going to see the doctor when you need to or an option for childcare, and that all kind of plays into this for you.
Very much so. Literally just in the week just gone, you know, we had to sell cattle, and that's a sale that's worth probably a third of our yearly income. And my husband got steel in his eye the day before.
Oh, no.
So it was an option of, you know, we couldn't put that truck off. So was I, you know, driving him into the closest town, which is 30K, and they might not have been able to do anything, or did I take him 120K to Roma? And potentially not be there to do the mustering and the everything. So he ended up just having to power through it, which was, you know, not much fun for him, obviously.
That's crazy.
But it's that sort of calculation every time of if something goes wrong, there's not much of a safety net, to be honest.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Renee Vincent, a Queensland cattle farmer and stay-at-home mum who's pushing back against the tradwife stereotype. And I'd love to hear if people have made assumptions about you and your life and how that's landed for you. My number is 0418-226-576. Margaret says, because I don't have children, chose not to. My pets are my child substitutes. I think that is an assumption that people have made about her. Renee, in the absence of piling on with the trad wife trend, what do you wish people understood about the realities of rural women in Australia?
Probably just what it actually looks like. I mean, it's a very domestic stereotype, I suppose. You know, your CWA mum who has the scones on the table for smoko when the men come in. But I don't know any women who aren't out there working side by side with their husbands. It's so much more of a partnership than a submissive role, which is what I suppose tradwife has always sounded like to me.
Mm. What do you hope changes about the way we talk about women or view women who find themselves in these more traditional roles?
It's not always a choice, you know. The domestic side of it has to be done. If you have kids, someone has to look after them. And quite often the way that that role will play out is out of your hands because, especially on a property, there are certain things that I just am so much less capable of than what my husband is. But that doesn't mean that we're not equals, you know. We're a very happy partnership that work very well together. But if there's a certain pump that needs to be started, we both know that it hates me and I can't do it.
Oh, well, Renee, I better let you get back to the cows and the kids, but thank you so much for sharing your experience with me. Renee Vincent lives on a cattle property an hour north of Roma in the southwest of Queensland. And thank you for your texts on Renee's story as well. One says, urbanites need to get out and live the rural life before romanticising it. My mother worked hard for her whole life of 85 years, bringing up 4 kids, supporting dad on the farm, long hours, hard physical work, starting from 6 a.m. till 9 p.m. in summer on an agricultural farm, including vineyards. It's not romantic. It's realistic and practical. Retail shops are few and far in between, and so-called daylight saving means longer hours for farmers as they don't change their hours. Another says, loved Renee's words, saying she and her husband as a partnership, working together and doing what each can do best, assumptions that men and women have fought to break out from. Liz says, sometimes people look at a woman and only see her domestic role. They don't see the huge juggling act behind the front, the part-time work, the relationships management, the volunteering, the study. It's annoying. And one more from Jen in Ballarat. Tradwife seems to be some confected intimate internet 2-minute trend, so far from real lives. Renee sounded to me describing a fairly normal rural Australian life, apart from maybe needing to homeschool, less common where I am in Victoria. Why has it become mixed up with this nonsense fad? This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. So throughout July, we've been bringing you stories of what it means to be a grandparent in 2026. And one thing you've been telling me about over and over again, especially the grandfathers out there, is how much grandparenting has been a time to reinvent yourself. And earlier in the show, you heard from Julian Mather. He felt this really keenly when his grandson Remy arrived, and he's now rethinking what it means to be a modern granddad. Here's a little bit of what he said to me earlier in the show.
I would like to see granddads elevated from a hobby to a leadership role. And Alistair was talking about dad's not having the time now with working to fulfil that leadership. And it's not about taking over that role, but stepping up and helping within that role. I just see there's an opportunity. But in my experience with trying to connect with these other men, I found that I'm wondering, is granddad out of date? Is that term, is that language? Because, you know, I mean, I've got 15, 20 years of energy and contribution left in me, but we talk about grandparents, we still have this role of, you know, this idea of people sitting in a rocking chair in, you know, late 60s, 70s with a rug on their lap, and it couldn't be further from the truth.
Amanda, what are the mental health benefits if people take up the grandparenting mantle in the way that Julian and Alistair are talking about?
I think it allows for people who are going through multiple changes in later life. It gives them that opportunity to not just be engaging, but to get something out of it that goes both ways, because they get to impart this knowledge, and in particular the word wisdom. I think as we get older and we develop this wisdom and we learn these different things, then we're much better able to engage in these kids in a way that we weren't able to when we didn't have that knowledge. And also the idea of leaving a legacy, you know, as you get older, you're not necessarily thinking of the word legacy, but you're thinking about, okay, well, how am I going to leave my mark on the world? Like, how can I teach these young people? And so being able to take over a more active role in care, I think, provides such a unique opportunity to be able to incidentally impart that knowledge. You know, suddenly you've got a two-year-old who's fascinated in what you're doing. Show me how to do that thing. And so a lot of the time it's not even active teaching, it's just all this incidental sharing back and forth of stories and skills and things that otherwise you just wouldn't have the opportunity to learn. So I think, yeah, it'd be interesting to see the suggestion of what we would use instead of grandparenthood, because I think that we get this idea in our head of what a grandparent looks like and this old aged stereotype, and it's simply not true. You know, we're seeing more sprightly older adults, if you will. You know, you don't feel old. You know, you want to be out there and playing with these kids. And so it's important people don't get stuck on this idea of, oh no, now I'm old, what do I do? I should be sitting down, my knees are gone. No, the more we can get you out and engaging with these kids, the better, because you realise that that stereotype doesn't hold true and you have so much to teach these kids, especially for granddads, I think.
Julian Mather and Dr. Amanda Salmon speaking to me earlier in the show. If you want to listen to the full chat with those two, and also Alistair, the author of a book about the history of fathering in Australia, it was such a great chat. And you can catch all of the episodes of The Grandparent Trap now, including stories from modern granddads Ray Martin and Malcolm Turnbull. Just search for The Grandparent Trap on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Well, that's just about it for Life Matters. I've come to you today from Jagera and Turrbal land. I'll be back with you again tomorrow. We're going to talk about smoking rates. On paper, they're going down, but is illicit tobacco leading us into a false sense of security? And what do we do about it? Plus, there's an upcoming exhibition at the State Library of Victoria that's got me thinking about how little things that don't mean much in the moment can become so valuable the older they get. So I want to know what's in your special keepsake box that's just gotten more valuable to you over time. And how telling kids that they can be anything can backfire. That's all coming up tomorrow on Life Matters with me, Tegan Taylor. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.